Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome. Here we are, church. Isn't that a good feeling? To me, when I look out at a crowd, I get in my heart the same kinds of excitement and energy that must have stirred the bosom of my distant relative, Phineas Taylor Barnum. And yes, indeed, he was my great-great-grandfather's fifth cousin. I'm telling you. So I'm going to take all the glory that's due to him and try to use it today for my own energy. I'm going to start today by asking you about these three quotes. Have you recognized any of these? Who said, "There's a sucker born every minute"? "Every crowd has a silver lining." And "The same spirit governs my enemies that burnt to death Michael Servetus by order of John Calvin." All three of those were said by Phineas Taylor Barnum, the greatest showman of the 19th century. Few folks who know his fame are aware that Barnum, the founder of Barnum and Bailey Circus, the greatest show on earth, was an ardent Universalist and a promoter not only of Siamese twins, midgets called General Tom Thumb and the Fiji Mermaid, but also of the progressive social causes and bold new Universalist religious beliefs of his time. So today I'd like to introduce them to you as part of your UU heritage and see if we can find some source of inspiration in his life for our times. It's lucky that you invited me. Actually, I invited myself. Today, because P.T. was born on July 5th. This is P.T. Barnum's birthday, 1810, and he wrote in his autobiography, "I'd have enjoyed being born on the 4th of July, but maybe my tardiness was for the best. Competition between Barnum and Independence Day would have been too much." Why was P.T. Barnum so famous? It's possible that those of you that are younger, and by younger I mean younger than me, obviously, maybe you've never actually seen a circus parade. Some of you may not know what a humbug is. So I'm going to give you a brief summary of his very, very long and colorful life. He's most famous for founding the National Traveling Circus. It's today called Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. It's going to be pulling into the Arrowhead Pond in about 2 weeks. No, they didn't pay me to say that. This is going to be its 138th edition. That means that Barnum created an American tradition in entertainment that has endured continuously every year for over a century. Thank you, Donnie. Only Walt Disney and his Magic Kingdom has been as dear to the hearts of American children over many years. But long before the first big top was raised with his name on it, his Barnum's American Museum was the marvel of New York City. It helped him amass a fortune. There he exhibited everything from white whales, well, Moby Dick had just been published and we have to hype that, and huge tanks and bearded ladies. He lived in a huge palace called Iranistan. It was meant to look like Aladdin's palace. It would be, I think, a lot like Michael Jackson's Neverland. He met the Queen of England. He delivered inspirational lectures like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. And he is responsible for the color-coded tickets that correspond to your seating in a large auditorium. Also for the concept of a rain check. You know, take a rain check on that. He made that idea up. And if you know the word jumbo, something that's very big, that came from the jumbo elephant that he brought to the United States. His autobiography, when published, was one of the best-selling books in America, second only in that time to the Bible. I'm not kidding. Perhaps he was so successful because he was born ideally suited for what was the exact opposite of our times. It was an entertainment-starved age in American history. And now we have an entertainment-saturated age in American history. So let's look at, and I'm in a pulpit, so I'm going to talk now about the dominant religious background of that time during his upbringing in small-town Connecticut. In 1810, most Americans were strict Congregationalists. These were basically the Puritans that had come over. in 1620s and 40s. It was the official religion of the state of Connecticut, where he was born. In churches, basic Calvinism was taught, and this was about 35 years after the American Revolution. What was taught in church on a Sunday, what P.T. sat through, was that man is by nature sinful and depraved. Salvation has already been predestined or decreed for the special folks among us called the elect. Good works would not achieve that salvation, wouldn't affect your fate if you had already been damned to hell. But people worked very hard at being extra virtuous, because obviously if you were running around being an idiot, everyone would know you were one of the future damned. But these beliefs produced a dour hopelessness and severity in the New England popular culture, which we associate a lot with Puritanism. P.T. sat in Sunday school every week. He received this religious instruction, but he refused to accept it. It never, ever conformed to his spirit. And he was aided by a role model, his own grandfather, and his grandfather's name was Phineas Taylor, his mother's father. Phineas Taylor was a universalist. It was a bold, new idea coming into the pulpits of the time. And the central teaching of the universalist movement was the love of God for all God's children, which sounds like, oh, what a no-brainer, duh. But what it meant then was that there were not just the elect and the damned. It meant that all were saved by the redeeming love of God. Churches, therefore, were for all souls, not just for the elect. And they're still called universalist all souls churches. And young Barnum really found this to be what he agreed with. Now, how might that affect his career in entertainment? Understand that at that time, influenced by this Calvinism, it was sinful to seek out any kind of entertainment for its own sake. That was self-indulgent. Entertainment was scarce. If you went to any kind of entertainment, it was probably a lecture on the topics of the evils of alcohol, or perhaps a demonstration of an interesting new farm machine. In the pulpit, ministers preached against the theater, against the morals, the bad morals, even in Shakespeare's plays, against the dissipated lives of actors. Well, we could still criticize Lindsay Lohan. Anyway, theaters did harbor pickpockets and ladies of ill repute, and to be frank, they were no place for women and children. All of you that just went to the AMC. One result of these limited options for any kind of what we would call fun was that there was a Yankee cultural tradition of playing practical jokes. And that was something people found time for. It was one of the few things you could do. P.T.'s grandfather, Phineas, was a huge practical jokester, and he taught this to the young boy as he grew up on a farm. Grandfather was especially hostile toward the local Congregationalist clergy. He played tricks on them. He felt they were bigoted and self-righteous, was annoyed by their pomposity. Classic example is he was traveling aboard a ship coming back to harbor with some ministers, and he convinced them to share his razor. But he said, there's a lot of us, so we'll each raise half of our face, and then we'll sharpen it. So they all raised half of their beard off, and then he took it to sharpen it, went overboard, and he sent off the ship ministers with half of a beard on. Had to get in the pulpit that same day. Phineas also tricked a young P.T. by telling him that one day he would proudly inherit a piece of land. It was called Ivy Island. But when he was 12 and he went to visit it, he found it was a useless, snake-infested swamp worth nothing to anyone. So as he was starting his career, he's about 12 and a store clerk, he also found that this New England cultural tradition, the trickster, the prankster, included everyday little tricks like adding those few rocks to a potato sack, or selling a little carved piece of wood as a piece of nutmeg. And this cultural tradition probably forced him to come up with the concept of it's important to always be clever, to be, as the Bible says, wise as serpents while innocent as doves. You have to be smart. You have to keep your eyes open. Maybe even laugh, learn to laugh at your own folly when you realize how cleverly you've been tricked. So let's move on to entertainment. Mr. Barnum now is tired of being a store clerk. He's found a beautiful young girl named Charity. He married her age 19, had a long and loyal marriage, several children with her, and he moved to New York City, ready to make his way in the big town and arrive there, for all of you that are 20-year-olds, right there at the height of a depression. No work. That city was in the, was a big economic depression. So he starts to desperately scramble for any way to make his living. One venture that he tried was selling Sears pictorial illustrations of the Bible. And he was very successful at this. He made a lot of money. And then he started to contract agents who robbed him blind, and he ended up with no money at all for that. So, and this happened a lot. Actually, he was rather naive. He ended up often, he lost his fortune several times, and sometimes for this kind of thing. So here he is in the Depression, looking around, what can I do, what can I do? And he saw what he thought was a perfect opportunity. He met up in a hotel with a man who was exhibiting Miss Joyce Heth. This was a slave woman that he was touring as the oldest woman in the world. And the exhibitor showed Phineas Taylor Barnum a bill of sale that would make her 160 years old. And she claimed that she had been George Washington's nurse. And in fact, would gladly tell you stories about that when she used to raise little Georgie. Now, Barnum cannily knew that entertainment was not going to sell to New Englanders, the idea that it's entertainment. But loving and responsible children could take their parents, could take their children to this because it was educational. This was all about the father of the country. It was historical. So he purchased her, and he promptly manumitted her. And that word, which you haven't heard for a long time, means freed her. Why? And here's one of his first social causes. Because Barnum was an ardent and lifelong abolitionist. He deplored slavery. He believed, along with other universalists, that God looks with an equal eye upon all his children. And he donated lots of money throughout his life to this movement and also to the universalist churches that were supporting it. So he now has purchased and freed a very, very poor elderly woman, blind and partly paralyzed. So when he offers her a job, touring with him, surprisingly, she took that right away. He would book a hotel, hand out flyers, and she would reminisce to visitors about her young ward. And this was a moderately successful venture. But it wasn't too long before she died. And then again, he had no source of employment. A postmortem found her to be about 80 years old. So was he the one that was fooled, or was he fooling the public? Well, that's always the question. This was the first of what people called his famous hoaxes or humbugs. Now he had developed this real taste for life and show business, and he soon found a juggler, plate spinner, named Signor Antonio, who he booked and managed. But there was an even bigger opportunity. In New York City, an old museum, Mr. Scudder's Museum, had become available. It was a collection of old relics. Barnum's imagination was just electrified by this new opportunity. There were several bidders. He had no money, but he offered the best bargain. He said he would pay the highest price, but he would be paying it every month as he ran the museum. And if he was ever late on the payment, he would leave the premises the next day. And, of course, what closed the deal was he offered as collateral that valuable piece of property, Ivy Island. And the owner agreed to his terms. Now he could make what he valued, which was family entertainment that was educational and morally uplifting. Remember, please, that he did consider himself a religious and God-fearing man. And he would sometimes stand up and talk back to ministers in church who railed against the vices of entertainment. Now he could manifest his vision, just as Walt Disney created Disneyland as a new Mecca instead of the seedy carnivals he had to take his family to. Barnum now redecorated. He mounted, just try to imagine it, paintings of animals, flags of the world on the top floor, and he installed the first stoplight, a Drummond spotlight. So here it is, New York City, lit up at night. For the first time, people had seen something marvelous. What's going to come in here? It was the five-floor Barnum's American Museum. So we don't have our little virtual reality tour. We'll have to do it with our own brain. Let's take a quick tour. We're on the first floor, big water tank. What is swimming in it? A hippopotamus, advertised as the behemoth of the Bible, because it's religious, people will go for it. And people had not seen these creatures before. As I said, when Moby Dick became a bestseller, he decided to do that synergy, and he found little white beluga whales to put in there. He was going to go with that. Second floor was full of bizarre oddities. It would be similar to Ripley's, believe it or not. And on that floor, you would find his wax figures, but also things like your two-headed calves, the bearded lady, and people who would, in the past would have toured as freaks in a circus sideshow. So I'm going to comment briefly on Barnum as a, in terms of social causes and his universalism, this idea of God looks with an equal eye upon all his children, because he had lifelong relationships with people that we would call freaks. Remember that at that time, there were probably a lot more people being born that looked different. There was not the medical and prenatal care, the genetic testing. People would usually be kept in a dark room away from public eye, and instead of exhibiting them as behind canvas flaps as a sideshow, they would be sitting in as if they were in their own living room, and people could chat with them as they passed through the exhibit. So it was and they were supporting themselves. It was a much more dignified thing. And I just want to remind you, too, that Barnum himself actually was one of the exhibits. On that floor, he had his own office open to the public, and some people bought a ticket just to go and look in the door and see, oh, that's Barnum. So he exhibited himself on that floor with the other people. Third floor was lecture hall, actual theatrical shows for his progressive social causes. For example, how about this one? Temperance. He was an ardent temperance man, and if you don't know what that means, it means don't drink alcohol. He was like DARE program. Teetotaler. And his employees, Disney-like, not allowed to drink, required to have good moral character. He commissioned a very famous melodrama called The Drunkard that preached against the evils of alcohol. And his other shows promoted causes like Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. After all, her father, Henry Ward Beecher, was his personal friend. He also had patriotic displays in support of the Union during the Civil War. Bands like this one would be playing in this lecture hall. Let's walk up to the fourth floor where the original collection is. That includes 200 Revolutionary War articles and lots of Native American items. And then you're up at the top on the fifth floor, where he had an exhibit called The Happy Family, a Bible-based exhibit in which he paired natural enemies, such as, you know, the verse, the lion shall lie down with the lamb. So lions and lambs would be there. I don't know how he got them in the same pen. Cats and mice, but this was his concept. The Happy Family exhibit was on the top floor. From there, you'll go get your ice cream and look out and enjoy the city of New York. Really think about how marvelous this was for the working man. A quarter for all this vast collection of entertainment. Think about Hello, Dolly, because that Cornelius and Barnaby are going out on Sunday, put on your Sunday clothes, to Barnum's Museum in that song. The working man, any man in the whole city, and this was important to Barnum, could buy a ticket and provide this educational, morally uplifting, fantastic entertainment. So my time is going to, I'm going to compress my incredibly hard labored over thing. I'm going to look like, I'll say those 2 pages, then I'm going to move right along here, because I'm going to move on to what happens as he becomes more influential. He is very wealthy and prosperous, and he lives in a conservative state, religiously and politically, and Barnum considered himself a free thinker. He really was annoyed by overzealous Christians in his community. He felt that, now you go, this guy was putting on hoaxes. Why would he be so indignant about morals? Well, he felt that competition was desirable, but actual dishonesty was completely unethical, broken contracts. So he started a newspaper called 1831, The Herald of Freedom. 3 times he was sued for libel. 1 time he claimed a Congregationalist minister was charging usurious interest rates. Usury means charging very, very high interest rates. Charging interest rates to an orphan, mind you, an orphan. And actually, this crime is condemned in the Bible. Well, actually, it was true, but the judge was friend of the accused. Fined and sentenced him to 60 days in jail, and he served his sentence, and that's when he proclaimed, "The same spirit governs my enemies that burnt Michael Servetus by the order of John Calvin." However, bad publicity is better than no publicity. Subscriptions to the newspaper jumped due to his martyrdom, even though his cell was wallpapered, carpeted, served as a meeting place for him and his friends when he was released from jail. This is amazing. Escorted by 60 carriages, 40 horsemen, and again a band playing. There's so much more we could look at, and maybe I'll do it, because I'm not even going to get to when he was in the circus, but I'm going to kind of wrap up so that we have time for our, and he would highly have approved of our pre-congregational meeting and our self-governance and so forth. I'm going to go back really towards the end of his life, because the number of stories that could be told really require just a vast amount of time. So I'm going to offer the summary of what happens as he's now become the famous circus promoter. He didn't even start that till he was 60 years old, after his house and the museum had burned down two times. He's 60 years old. He amasses that fortune again. And we'll talk to you about the end of his life. He lived into his 80s. He had hoped to join the opening of the 1891 circus season. There would have been a big torchlight parade scheduled on March 26th. On March 24th, the New York Evening Sun published his obituary in advance. It said, "Great and only Barnum, he wanted to read his obituary, and here it is." On the last day he could move around his house, he wrote a final letter to his partner, Mr. Bailey, setting down his final beliefs. "You must have always a great and progressive show, one that is clean, pure, moral, and instructive. Never cater to the baser instincts of humanity. Always remember that children have been our best patrons." The Unitarian pastor Robert Collier presided over his funeral. Universalist pastor Louis Fisher said, "If being made for a thing is a divine call to that thing, then Mr. Barnum was divinely called to be a showman." And Barnum said of his life calling, "If I had been a clergyman, I could not have labored any more earnestly." And as I sum it up today, I'm going to suggest that we don't do time for a talk back because we want to get out and eat. And actually, I have some circus equipment in the car if you'd like to try it. I'm going to ask, what place would he have found in this century? We live in an absolutely entertainment-saturated world. Do we need to kind of rewind, go back the other direction? What progressive social causes would he find compelling in this internet age? Which of the causes that we support now will the nation sustain, and which ones may go by the wayside, like temperance? Is it possible that you youth can sometimes fall into the dour severity of the Calvinists? Could we sometimes use more of Barnum's universalist optimism and initiative and his willingness both to gain wealth and to spend it? Could he have helped us now cope with this depression? What good ideas would he have had? In other words, if he were alive today, what would PT do? Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.